Hello and welcome to Borderlines, a Canadian immigration law podcast. This is episode 100. It's hard to believe we've made it this far. We are joined today by Justice Edelman, one of the co-founders and past co-hosts of the Borderlines podcast. Peter Edelman was a very prominent crimmigration lawyer in Vancouver. He practiced both criminal law and immigration law in Vancouver before being appointed to the British Columbia Supreme Court in December 2019. This is his first episode on the podcast since he was appointed to the bench. He provides insight as to what it was like becoming a judge and what being a judge is like. It was great fun to have him on. We recorded this podcast in Justice Edelman's chambers, which is judicial speak for office. And once again, if you like the podcast, please leave a review on iTunes, and I hope you enjoy this episode. It was real fun and a treat to record.
Do you want to do the intro?
I don't know if I remember.
We don't even really have like the same, you know, we don't start with the whole hello and welcome to the...
Hello and welcome to Borderline?
Yeah. We just dive in and then pick a spot where we're going to like actually start the episode. Mm-hmm. But episode 100, we are here, still here.
The old, kicking it with the old posse.
That's right.
Yeah. It's been what, 3 years since you went to the bench? 3 years since you called and said you need to get your equipment.
There you go. For you. No, it's been 4 years. It's
2020.
December 2019.
December 2019.
Wow, yeah. Time flies.
So it's been over 4 years. All coming on 4.5.
What do we call a provincial court judge? Mr. Justice Edelman? Is that what you are? Justice Edelman.
And we are sitting here in chambers with a nice view of House Street.
Yeah.
Nice. Well, welcome.
Thank you. It's very nice to be here. Yeah.
We had two other judges who thought that Deanna and I were recently appointed justices drop by. But once they learned that we were recording an immigration podcast, they seemed less interested. Where do we even start? A lot of colleagues have commented. Well, just how you're doing. How's Peter?
Well, you know, It's been an odd few years because I think for everybody, I got appointed, as I said, in December 2019, and then things shut down in March. So it was a bit of a rather odd few years for everybody because with COVID and everything else, and I had my concerns for, you know, because I had left the practice with Aaron and Erica with the idea that, oh yeah, everything's running smoothly. And then it turned out my concerns that they were not going to have work those were definitely not concerns, it turns out.
Yeah. You know,
they have another case going to the Supreme Court.
Yeah.
We'll check it and keep going.
Oh yeah. They're quite, the office seems to... They've been able to keep things going, and which is nice, and they were thriving. But the time after COVID,
you walked away, and they got hit with a pandemic, and like all of us had to figure out how to navigate through a pandemic in an immigration firm, which is very interesting.
Well, it also turned out that at least for their firm, that there was a lot of work as a result of the pandemic, opposed to in certain other areas where there was just a lack of work.
But yeah. So when you become a judge, is it immediately like you can't work on any of your old files?
Yeah, I had to drop. I mean, for me, it had worked out relatively well because I was the week that I was appointed was right before the Christmas break, and I had one big case that I was preparing arguments for, and so I had cleared the decks to be able to write on that one case. So everything was already kind of cleared, and it wasn't like I was about to go into court on a bunch of things. And so I dropped that in Erica's lap, which I'm sure she was... You could ask Erica how she felt about that, but otherwise it was... but yes, you get the call from the minister and you are a judge at that point. You are no longer a lawyer.
And they have to take control of your... Because you owned a firm, like... They have to take control of your email. How do you unwind being a partner at a firm once you're a judge? Like, does someone step in, or are you part of those?
Oh no, you can still, like, as in that first period of time, you can still do. You just can't practice law, so okay. You can't be practicing. You're not. You're meeting. You know, in some cases, I was meeting with clients, but the meeting with the clients was not to give them legal advice. The meeting with the clients was to transition them to the new lawyers. I mean, obviously, I knew that I had applied and we had a succession plan in place. And so on most of my files, I had other lawyers who were working on my files, which was true in any case. A lot of my files, I was working collaboratively with other people, either in the firm or outside the firm.
What about like AR, like money that comes in after you become a judge? Are you still able to collect it, or does it go...
Oh yeah, those are arrangements that people make in different ways, depending on the structure. But we had structured our partnership agreement with the understanding that I had applied to become a judge, and we had kind of structured it in a way that would make that transition smooth. So it's more of a question of depending on the firm. What ends up happening is that depending on how tied you are to the firm, it creates conflicts on an ongoing basis. And so some of my colleagues may have ongoing conflicts depending on how long it takes from the time of their appointment until they no longer have financial attachments to their old firms, right? So that may create a circumstance where you recuse yourself from more cases over a period of time. But there are certain people but over time, there's less and less people that I would recuse myself in terms of the cases. It's just...
That's in the lead up to becoming a judge?
No, once I am a judge. It's a question of whether or not I would recuse
myself. Oh, like whether Erica can appear before you or something like that.
Yeah, so like there's some people that I just wouldn't... Even now, I just have to, for different reasons, I have close friendships with, or that I have relationships with, that I wouldn't have them appear before me. And then there's other people where over time I would likely be more comfortable having them appear in front of me. I mean, in this case, it's like the likelihood that either of you would appear in front of me is unlikely. But when I was first appointed, it might have been more uncomfortable than it would be now. As to whether or not I would have either of you appear in front of me at this point.
We've both been, I think, experts on immigration issues. Like, could we appear as experts before you?
Well, what I would be doing in those circumstances, if one of you were to appear as an expert before me, then I would just disclose to the parties that, look,
that we were here.
I used to do a podcast with these people. They're colleagues that I have a particular relationship with. I either do or don't see a problem with this. Ultimately, it's up to me to decide if it would make me bias, if there would be an appearance of bias, or if it would. So ultimately, it's up to the judge to decide whether or not they'd be comfortable. There are certain of my, people that I mentor quite closely. I don't think maybe ever I would have appear in front of me. There are some people that I just had a particularly close working relationship with, and then there are some people that I've maintained relationships with in terms of friendships and whatnot, where I wouldn't have them appear, where I would recuse myself if they were counsel on a case. But it would, but that's ultimately a judgment call for the judge in a given case to make. Sometimes it's very obvious, and sometimes it's a judgment call for the judge who's sitting on the case as to whether or not they feel they ought to recuse themselves.
I'm interested because you are a lawyer with a robust practice. You've been doing this immigration practice for many years. You had a firm of your own, working with associates. What made you decide that you wanted to leave the practice of law and become a judge in the first place?
a good question. I mean, it was something that I was, so I was a, there was a period of time where I was approached by more than one person about going to the judiciary. And at the time it was discussions around going to the federal court. And it wasn't something that I had been on. I wasn't on the judicial track, so to speak, in the sense that it wasn't something that I had foreseen myself doing. Mm-hmm. But I was at a stage in my career where I was thinking about it, and the more I thought about it, the more I was ready for a change. Mm-hmm. I saw that there were things that I might be able to contribute in a role in the judiciary that would be different than what I was contributing in terms of the work as counsel. So it was something that it was more a question of I was at a stage, I think, in life and in my career where I was ready to try something different. Mm-hmm. And the people, there were a few people that I spoke with who were quite convincing in terms of encouraging me to do that. And so it was, ultimately it was a decision that I was in a very fortunate position because I had just taken, the people I was working with were people that I worked with quite well. I enjoyed the practice that I was doing. I was doing more and more of the type of legal work that I found quite interesting. And the firm was structured in a way that allowed me to do that. And so I was in a very fortunate position in that way, that it wasn't something that I don't think I would have been miserable if I hadn't become a judge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
In the end, it's been a very positive transition for me, in the sense that it's given me an opportunity to step back and look at things from a broader perspective. Mm-hmm. Which practice, there's a lot of day-to-day aspect to practice that doesn't allow me to step back and look at the mm-hmm. bigger picture.
Yeah.
And there's something about the specialization. I had a diverse but a highly specialized practice, especially compared to what I do now, in the sense that I sit on a generalist court now, and I really get a very broad perspective of the types of legal issues and how the legal system works and affects people in their lives, where my focus was very narrow in my practice before. And so that's been a good... but just in terms of the time, a lot of the parts of practice that I had before just aren't a part of my day-to-day life.
One of the questions we got asked kind of on that theme is, and you mentioned that you'd been considering, or at least there were discussions about federal court. What made you choose to go BC Supreme Court over federal court?
It was not...
which is probably the big question people ask is, why didn't he become an immigration, quote unquote, an immigration judge?
Yeah, and quite frankly, it's something that I would have... the work on the federal court I find very compelling, and I'm very... I think it's good to see some of the recent appointments to the federal court are people that I think bring a lot of experience from the immigration, like... Justice Grant or Justice Sandra Hashimi, Justice Azmudeh. So there's a number of people who have been appointed in recent times that I think do, and I think in terms of bringing that and doing that work, it's something that I would, and I think I still would find compelling. In terms of the challenges with the federal court, a lot of the federal court's work is in Eastern Canada. Mm-hmm. And my family's here, and that's not true. Justice, and this was before COVID. And so at the time I was making my decision, things were not done remotely. Things were not done, like things were done in person. It was a very different time. So like I was applying, I was thinking about this, it would have been in 2017, 28, coming into 2018, in terms of what, but I had always done work in the Supreme Court in any event. So my practice was very divided.
Immigration.
Yeah, so I did do a lot of criminal extradition.
Right.
So I was doing quite a bit of work on the criminal side and on the immigration side. And it's something that the, in terms of the breadth of what I do, I still do a lot of judicial review. I do a lot of administrative law, just with different tribunals in the sense of sometimes I discover, you know, the provincial tribunals is much like at the federal level, but there's I discover new tribunals all the time.
And there's immigration stuff that goes, like, that's not done in federal court, like some of the habeas corpus. Yeah. Ontario recently struck down the second generation citizenship on descent limitations.
Yeah.
You mentioned you're a generalist. What does that mean?
So we're a generalist court in the sense that, so some courts have specialized divisions. So if you go in Ontario, for example, they have a family division, they have a criminal division. They also, you'll also have lists. In other words, in some courts, there will be people who do, you'll have judges who specifically do class actions, or they specifically do certain types of corporate commercial work or bankruptcy work or whatever the situation might be. In our court, for the most part, we are generalists. There are specially assigned cases, and there are judges who obviously specialize in certain areas, certain more more specialized areas. There will be, in particular, complex cases would be assigned to those judges, complex criminal work or complex bankruptcy work, things like that will tend to be assigned to judges. But for the most part, we are a generalist court in the sense that I do everything from family to class actions to criminal, you know, I do jury trials. I do, there's some things that only some of us, so for example, there's a very small subset of us who do trials in French. But that's just a question of linguistic ability. But otherwise, and we also travel throughout the province. So I will sit in places like, you know, Prince George or Port Alberni or whatever the, and when you're in a smaller, especially when you're in a smaller venue, you do everything that needs to be done in that venue, right? Including approving probate applications and desk order divorces and all of the things that are part of the jurisdiction of the Supreme Court. We do it all in the 2 week period that I'm sitting in Rossland or whatever the.
Yeah. How are you expected to learn the law in an area that you're doing for the first time? Like, is it just you walk in kind of a blank slate and two sides argue, like the notion we have of the adversarial system, or do you have to brief up on it? Like that first time you're doing family law, mortgage.
Yeah. I mean, ultimately it's going to be, so some of it, we will get training on the more, let's say the bigger, let's say the more common cases, but there are certain types of, or areas of law in which we would get training on criminal law or on the law of sex assault or jury trials, and where there's judicial training, and the quality of the judicial training is quite good, like in terms of the CLEs and whatnot that we have access to, is quite good. We can also go, we also attend CBA or other types of training to keep up to speed in different areas of the law that we feel that we need to be familiar with. But for the most part, it's counsel, especially in the more esoteric areas, which was a big part of my work when I was counsel, was educating immigration decision makers on criminal law issues and educating criminal law adjudicators, judges on immigration issues. And so a lot of what I did when I was counsel, was coming into criminal court and explaining to a criminal judge, this is what the immigration consequences are. This is how the immigration system works. This is what those, and so part of it is the more, and my experience has been that the more esoteric the area, the more counsel are very much used to and ready to walk me through what the law is and how the law works in that area. But in any area, it's more, and the longer I've been doing it, the more comfortable I am just saying to counsel, I don't know what that is. I don't know anything about this area. You need to start from the beginning. Or then there's some areas where it's like, I have done a number of cases in this area, and I'll just tell, look, I'm familiar with the test.
Yeah.
I've done this. Why don't you focus on the application of the test?
Right? Have you had where like two lawyers on an esoteric area are presenting two opposite versions of what the law is? And how do you then as judge cipher through that or determine what the law is?
Well, that is my job.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, that's ultimately up to me. They're going to give me the cases. And I will read the cases, and I'll look at the law myself, and I'm ultimately the one who will decide what the law is in those areas. And there are situations where in areas that I know nothing about, or that there just haven't been, or that I previously knew very little about, that I have to take the time to educate myself and to understand the law in that area, see where the lines are drawn, and make a decision that ultimately, you know, it's reviewable in the Court of Appeal or in the appellate courts. But ultimately, that's the role that I have as a Superior Court judge, is that I'm making the decision.
The findings of fact.
The findings. I make the findings of fact, but I also need to decide what the law is. And so ultimately, I need to figure that out and be satisfied for myself, even when counsel agree on what the law is.
Yeah.
It's still up to me to be satisfied that actually is the applicable law in the circumstances. And from time to time, I will disagree with counsel on what the applicable law is and ask for further submissions or say, well, there's this case that seems to say the opposite of what you both told me. Can you please comment on that? Right. And so those are the types of situations where sometimes my clerk will bring something to my attention that neither counsel have brought to my attention. You know, we do have access to clerks, not at the level that they do at the Supreme Court of Canada, but we have, I have a clerk that I share with a few other judges, but they're very bright. They're very diligent in terms of when I need assistance in terms of finding things or getting information. They're quite helpful in that way as well. So, and then ultimately it's a very collegial environment. And so we will have discussions with other judges. Other judges are very, in my experience, there is very rarely any suggestion of what you should do in the case. It's more, here's my understanding of the law. Yeah. Here's where the lines are drawn. Here's the case you want to read. You want to go and look at this. Here's a resource. This paper was written on this, or here's the leading book in this area. You want to look at this at this material. Here are the things you want to consider. But in terms of the actual decision, that's a decision that you need to, that I need to make myself, right? And so, but overall, it's a very collegial environment as well. So there's usually, for the most part, in the more common areas of the law on the court, there's usually two or three of the leading experts in that area are on the court. Because those are the people who tend to get appointed to the court. And so we have among the leading experts in class actions and bankruptcy and criminal law and family law, they're all members of our court. And so when there's something particularly easy to, there's a particular dilemma in one of those areas of the law, just like in when I was in practice.
Yeah.
I wouldn't call Lord Waldman up all the time, but if I had a particularly thorny issue that nobody else was like, oh yeah, we can't figure that out, you give Lord or Bart or whoever it is a call. But that's the same thing here. We have, so there's a lot, the resources are quite good in terms of figuring those things out. And then ultimately we go back to council if we need more submissions or if we need a better understanding. Where it's challenging for me has been in the number of people who come before the court who are either self-represented or underrepresented. And that can be a significant challenge when you have, and that's a reality of, in certain, more so in certain areas of law than others, where there just isn't legal aid, there isn't anyone, you know, and so you're...
How often do you have it where it's two self-reps?
That's not an uncommon situation.
Yeah.
Like, are you talking about, like what kind of percentage of the cases? Like, are you talking more than half, or you're talking a smaller portion than that?
In Vancouver, it would be a much smaller portion than that. But okay. the makeup of the work in, so I'm a resident judge in Vancouver,
right?
And the makeup of the work in Vancouver we do a lot of work. Like, I've never seen a self rep on a class action, for example.
Right, of course.
In complex corporate commercial work, I've never seen.
Never.
Well, you see self-reps will be on the other. So, you know, for example, it's very common on judicial reviews of the Residential Tenancy Board,
right.
For example. So there, I don't know what the percentages are,
yeah.
But I would say that I more often than not,
right.
One, either the landlord or the tenant will not be represented.
Yeah.
Often both are not represented. So so it depends on the areas of law,
yeah,
right? Murder cases... You know, like in criminal law, people have a right to counsel. So Crown, there's always counsel on
right.
the prosecution side,
yeah.
And people have a right to counsel. If someone is self-represented on a criminal matter in our court, in other words, the given the stakes in our court, it's almost invariably because they're choosing to be self-represented.
Right.
So it depends on the area of law.
Yeah.
So in some areas, you'll see a lot more people representing themselves. Or when I say being underrepresented is that either in terms of, there's a wide variation of the caliber of counsel, but also where people are on limited retainers. So it's obvious that somebody, and you see this in family law very commonly, for example, when you have a high conflict family matter, people can't afford to have a lawyer there for every appearance,
yeah.
And everything. So there's a lawyer in the background that's more or less involved in
mm-hmm.
giving advice or helping to draft certain things or giving, but people are doing other parts of it themselves.
Right.
So that creates certain challenges.
I
that
can imagine.
Was
yeah.
not part of my practice before because I only all of my litigation was with the government on the other side.
Yeah.
And so...
And you were handling the entire matter, not just a section of that that litigation.
Yeah, it was rare for me to have a limited retainer
yeah.
in the type of work that I was doing.
Right.
That was just the nature of the cases that I was doing before. So that's been a learning experience for me in
sure.
terms of...
I can imagine, too, when there's one party who's represented and the other party who's not, just making sure that that imbalance doesn't skew the, you know, the advocacy. You kind of, it makes the work harder to make sure that the both sides of the case are being equally represented. Not represented, but they're both sides of the argument are fully considered before you render your decision.
Yeah. Well, and it's also a difficult balance to where on the one hand you want to make sure that there's a fair process.
Mm.
On the other hand, you can't jump into the fray
mm.
and be become the advocate for
sure.
the unrepresented party. It's a very challenging situation for judges in general. I mean, in terms of those circumstances are very, it's a delicate balance to have, and it does tend to take up a lot more time
mm.
Just in terms of ensuring that the process is fair
mm.
And so there but Yeah.
And also conducting the research, I imagine, because there's no one there. I wouldn't imagine that the parties themselves would be able to point you directly to the source of the law. That wouldn't necessarily be there.
No, it's in some cases, that's true. In other cases, like in some cases, it's quite where it becomes very challenging is where ultimately, like for example, in family law cases, you're dealing with the best interests of a child, and there, that's the prime concern. And it's not that one party or the other has the onus with respect to the child's best interests. You have to decide what's in the child's best interest.
Right.
And if you have you find yourself with materials that are incomplete or partly inadmissible or are for different reasons create challenges. But at the end of the day, you still have to decide if the child is going to go with parent A or parent B.
How hard is deciding? Like, I would imagine if I was a judge, I'd be someone who's like, oh, that argument makes sense. Oh, but that's a good argument too. And then you could do that forever. So how hard is it to actually like make a decision, or do you have strategies or processes that you've developed?
You know, I remember when we did the podcast with Justice Rothstein a few years ago,
yeah.
And I don't know if you remember when he was going through his experience on the courts, where when he was on the lower court, he was like, a lot of the decisions were easier, and as you get up to the Supreme Court of Canada, every decision is, they're all hard cases, I'm starting to understand what it is that he meant by that, in the sense that in a lot of cases it becomes pretty evident relatively quickly what it is that needs to be done, especially in cases where it's an on-off decision. It's a yes or no.
Yeah.
Either you've met the burden or you haven't.
Hmm.
You know what I mean? It's like either the Crown has proved the case beyond the reasonable doubt, or they haven't.
Right. There's a clear legal test, not like what is in the child's best interest, which seems much more nuanced and fact-driven, right?
Well, it's much more nuanced and fact-driven, and there's not a right or wrong answer.
Right.
There are just less good or...
Yeah.
More like there's a slightly better answer. Those I find are much more challenging.
Yeah.
Right.
And I spend a lot more time. They're just much more challenging decisions.
For sure.
Because it's not, well, either the case has been proven beyond a reasonable doubt or it hasn't.
Right.
It's a binary decision.
Right. For sure.
You're either guilty or you're not guilty. There's not an in between. There's not a, well, with parenting, parenting is an example where it's a very amorphous, and in fact they're even challenging decisions for those of us who are parents with our own children. I mean, they're not easy decisions to make.
For sure.
You know, should my kid wear a mask at school? Should he get vaccinated? Should he, like, those are decisions that we genuinely with my partner have discussions and disagreements about.
Change our minds.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah. And that very good friends of mine take opposite views on.
Yeah.
Right? That people who I respect very, that during COVID, it was an ongoing discussion about bubbles and who was going to go where. And so you can imagine how difficult that decision making is in a dysfunctional situation of separated or separating parents,
huge acrimony and
and so they come before me and say, oh, well, Justice Edelman, you should make the decision.
Right.
And I'm like, well, I'm not finding these decisions easy to make with respect to my own kids.
Yeah.
And so in a sense, but ultimately, I just like I do with my kids, I make the best decision that I can in the circumstances that I have with the guidance that I'm given.
Mm-hmm.
And so sometimes we do have guidance from experts, or we have guidance from different sources as to how it is to approach different things. And those are, But it's been a learning curve for me.
I imagine
in terms of thinking about those issues, because in the immigration context, we talk about best interest of the child, but it's a relatively and not to say I don't want to say it's simplistic, but my arguments were generally it's not in the child's best interest to report his or her dad.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Like generally the case.
Yeah.
Generally the case, right? Or it's not in the child's best interest to be deported to Somalia or whatever the situation is, right? Like those are...
They were unidimensional.
Whereas mom versus dad is a lot more...
It's because there's always ups, you know, and so it's a very different engagement with the best interest of the child. And I've found that I've been... the level of learning that I've done, which is one of the advantages of being on a generalist court, is that I've developed these insights from other areas that I never would have, and even now, a lot of the things that I've learned about the best interest of the child, about child psychology, about the dynamics in families and all of those things, those are things that I likely would have used. Yeah. And if I were to go back into doing immigration, I actually would take some of those insights and deploy them in the immigration context. The same thing with a lot of things that I hear. We do, for example, motor vehicle injury cases. I've learned an enormous amount about trauma and chronic pain and the cycle of the experiences that people have and the psychological impacts of those types of injuries that I had some interest. I had some understanding of from my refugee work, but I now have, you know, I hear from experts, I hear experts testify and be cross-examined on issues of the impact of trauma and all of those types of things, which we just didn't have in the refugee context.
Yeah.
And so, you know, those types of insights, I'm finding that as I look in different areas, it's the different areas actually inform each other's, and in some of the areas that I wouldn't have thought, it wouldn't have occurred to me the ways in which they are compelling.
Right.
Yeah.
But motor vehicle cases has been a good example of that, where it's like you see the impact of chronic pain or of disability in someone's life, and how that plays out in terms of their mental health, in terms of their emotional health, in terms of their overall experience of the world, and those are they're very compelling sets of circumstances that it wouldn't have based on my engagement with it in law school.
Yeah,
it's not something I would have foreseen as being a compelling area of the law.
Right? Yeah, one of the very limited positive developments I would say in the immigration field is there has been a much broader understanding of the impacts of trauma at the Refugee Protection Division. It has not so far spread to immigration proper, but we are doing an episode upcoming on the subject of trauma, and we will have some very interesting guests to talk to us about that. But yeah, definitely it's a huge kind of growth area. I think that there's just been an explosion too in terms of the research and the neuroscience around trauma and all of that sort of thing. So I can totally understand that now I think a lot more immigration practitioners are starting to include that type of submission in their humanitarian and compassionate and refugee style claims too. So I think the world is finally starting to catch up with it perhaps. But I think it happened much earlier in the provincial kind of court setting, and I think that the best interests of the child considerations have always been far more robust in the provincial court setting than they have ever been in the federal court immigration sector. So it's interesting that you have been able to like see that from both sides of it. It makes me wonder too, like you've talked about how your knowledge of other areas of law has been broadened, but I'm interested in how, you know, being at the bench, if like how that's changed your perspective, if it has, about what really effective advocacy looks like. And just, you know, were you surprised by any of that? Has it changed? Has it just confirmed what you already knew? What's your outlook on that?
I mean, I think so. I mean, one of the things I've definitely seen with advocacy is that different areas of the bar do different things well. Mm. And they do different things in, you know, and it's given me a certain amount of, where there's a focus on certain aspects. So for example, with respect to the best interest of the child in family law, right, where there's a level of engagement and knowledge and, ability to present that to the court, and the way that you engage with getting a views of the child report, how do you put the views of a child or the situation of a child forward. Family law obviously has developed a number of tools and approaches and advocacy techniques to do that that other areas of law simply haven't, because they don't engage with children on a day-to-day basis in their practices. The same thing with respect to issues around capacity and the estate bar, right? So in the wills and estates, they deal with issues of capacity and diminishing capacity. Does somebody have an ability to give legal instruction? There's a very sophisticated thinking around those things in wills and estates, for obvious reasons that you don't see in other areas of the law, right? And so what I've found is that different areas engage with things in different ways. I've found it, you know, in terms of my own thinking, that I see things happening across areas now that I was thinking of in silos when I was in practice. I mean, detention is a good example of that. So like detention and Section 7, I thought about in the criminal context. So there's bail, so you have bail, you have sentencing, you have corrections. There's the detention areas in bail or in the criminal context. And in the immigration context, they look somewhat similar. You detain people not for punishment, but for similar reasons as you do in the criminal context. But we also detain people in the civil mental health context, people who are found not criminally responsible by way of mental disorder. In the civil context, where people become committeeship for someone who has dementia or has Alzheimer's, where it's a private individual who essentially has control over somebody's ability to move around, or with respect to children, right? Where it's like we physically control our children, and there are very good reasons to physically restrain a child who's going to run across the street or whatever it is at certain ages, right? And I'm discovering in having a 14-year-old that there are also circumstances where the ability to constrain the child's movements are somewhat more constrained or are somewhat more
limited,
in flux. Yeah. Like, let's put it that way. At different ages we have. But when I was thinking about detention before, I'd be thinking about it in these silos, and even a lot of my practice at the time was trying to break between two silos, which was the immigration and the criminal. But going across those, there's definitely a certain perspective that it's pushed me to start to think about some of the more underlying principles in those things of like, what is it? Why is it that we detain people? Why is it that we constrain people? Yeah. And what does that mean in these different areas? Yeah. What does that mean when you look at this across the board? And that's the type of thing that when I see effective advocates will also, especially if they're asking me to do something with respect to the law, and I sometimes have, you know, where it's like, oh, well, this you should make an exception for this hearsay. And my first question would be, so how is this going to play out more broadly? And the sophisticated advocate will have thought that through.
Right, for sure.
The unsophisticated advocate will not. They'll be like, oh, no, but I just want you to make an exception for me. And it's like, well, no, I'm a Supreme Court judge. If I make an exception,
every line that you write is going to be poured over.
If I'm going to make an exception to the hearsay rule, that's a new exception, we're going to think that through, yeah. right? And what, how's that going to play out in estate law? How's that going to play out in these other areas of law? So it's like, this isn't just a one-off.
It's not a carve-out.
Yeah. A carve-out. And so when in terms of understanding what it is the judge is doing, and that's something that I definitely, and I realized, one of the big realizations for me in becoming, when I was first appointed, and realizing that I had never done as an advocate, was I had never done any training or reading on decision making.
Huh. Well, and that's so interesting.
And so the one thing that I now recommend to all junior counsel, that's when I talk to junior lawyers, one of the first things I recommend is pick up a book on decision making.
Huh.
Pick up a book on, or listen to the CIAJ has a podcast called In All Fairness.
Okay.
The first 5 episodes of that podcast are essentially the same people who give judges our
What's
new
CIAJ?
Judges training, the Canadian Institute for the Administration of Justice.
Okay.
And so they are involved in doing training for judges, and they have their first 5 episodes of their podcast are people like Judge Laskin and a number of, and they're the same people. Like my new judges training was a session that included Judge Laskin telling us, here's the point first writing, and these are the things that you want to be doing in decision making, and how to approach a decision, and how to approach writing a decision.
Yeah, I know that he has an article online on effective writing, I think.
Yeah.
I think, though, that when I'm sure that the two of you have had similar experiences, when you are bringing up new lawyers, the difference between one that's going to succeed and one that's not is whether or not they have the ability to make decisions. And I don't mean judicial decisions, obviously, but decisiveness is a really, like, it's a cornerstone of successful, not even just litigation, but the practice of law. And I think that that is something, and maybe you guys don't agree, but for me, when I find that I get jammed up in terms of the inability to render decisions quickly and definitively, then my whole practice starts to pile up on me. But it is, and that's part of what the stress is of running a practice, is like decision, go, implement, execute, you know, delegate, go. And you have to be doing that.
Yeah, that's something I sort of hinted at, which is like, even in just typing an email, you can stare at it and be like, are there any words that I want to change in this email before it goes out, before you eventually have to hit send? As a judge, you know, you're writing a decision that people are going to pore over. We recently did a podcast about a federal court decision where it was like, oh, it'd be so nice to be able to ask the judge like what they meant about certain things. I'm on a working group for the federal court, and there was a DOJ lawyer cited a judgment, and the judge who wrote the decision was on the call and said, well, I don't know if you should interpret what I wrote as that way. And it just made me think, like, how is it stressful or just accepted that, like, you'll put something out in writing and then you don't ever really have a chance to explain it, except maybe in a subsequent decision. And of course, you aren't allowed, if the media is criticizing you, to defend what you wrote. Like, is that stressful? Is it just you get used to it? I guess you have to get used to it.
Well, I mean, you know, it's not that different in my experience from the moment when I sit down in court. I get up, I make my arguments, and then I, you know, l'esprit d'escalier, the spirit of the staircase, that is the, like the, you know, that thing when you're walking down the stairs and you're like, I should have said.
Oh, right.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, oh, yeah. If only I had said. So anyway, in French, we call it l'esprit d'escalier, you know, the great witticisms you come up with in the staircase, right? And so that happened to me more often than not, pretty much every hearing I ever did as counsel, the hour afterwards, I had all kinds of great ideas and the things that I ought to have done, or more importantly, when the decision came down. Right. The decision came down and it's like, well, no, if I had known, then I would have argued this, right? I would have said, I should have put this in my factum, or I should have done this, right? And so to a certain extent that, you know, when you say that clicking send, or, you know, when I send the factum off, or when I said I send the argument off to CIC or when I do the, you know, whatever it is. And I mean, I remember looking in great detail, like, so on Tran, we argued Tran at the SCC. Mm-hmm. There were a set of submissions that were based on a Section 44 that had gone out under my name. And we're now being pored over by 30 lawyers,
right,
and 9 Supreme Court judges, line by line.
Yeah.
Would I have written those differently? Yeah, sure, I would have written those differently. Sure. Like, is it like there? But they were one of, I don't know how many sets of 44 submissions went out during that period of time.
For sure.
And they were not particularly unusual ones.
Yeah.
But, you know, would I have dealt with those differently?
Well, this takes me back to something that I was thinking at the very beginning, which is that we have seen a great exodus from the immigration bar of those who are specialized in litigation practice. Like, you know, many of our colleagues have gone to become members of the IRB or become judges of the federal court. You mentioned Justice Sadr Hashmi, you know, you left to do this thing. I think people are really struggling with the burnout, and not just because of what we've discussed about, you know, the decision making, but just also the consequences being so severe, you know, that like you're having to deal with volume, you're trying to minimize costs for your clients, like it's a lot to bear. And so I'm just curious, like, how does that compare to what it feels like to be in this position? Like the kind of wear and tear of practice as a litigator versus the stress of being a presiding judge.
I think it's a different, there's a different level of stress. I mean, for me, on the day to day, you know, I don't do timesheets.
What do you do day to day?
Well,
what does a judge do? Like, what dictates your schedule? Like?
Yeah.
So, I mean, basically, I have sitting weeks and I have non-sitting weeks. Mm-hmm. That my non-sitting weeks are either reserve weeks or are holidays.
Yeah.
But quite frankly, they're interchangeable in the sense that if I get my writing done, then my writing weeks can be holidays. Mm. If I don't get my writing done, my holidays become writing weeks, right?
Yeah.
And so they bleed into each other. To a certain extent, you set limits just like I did in practice.
Right. But you have to be efficient in your writing, otherwise you'll get buried in the decisions that you haven't written. Yeah.
Well, that's just like in practice. Exactly.
Yeah.
And so your sitting weeks will generate a need for decisions to be made.
Yeah.
And the sitting weeks are going to, you know, we're allocated a certain number of sitting days a year, and you sit that number of days in the year. And during your sitting weeks, they usually come in 3-week periods in our court, but that works differently in different courts, right? And so, but you know, where you have your sitting weeks, and you render decisions. In some cases, it's very different. So if I'm sitting on a jury trial, for example, there it's very intense during the trial, but I don't have to make the decision, right? So, but during the trial, mm-hmm. I have to make the mid-trial rulings, and it's not like I can sit on them for 3 weeks.
Mm.
I need to make a mid-trial ruling. They need a decision right now because I've got 12 people who are showing up tomorrow morning, or I can take a break of a day or two, but you've got 12 people who want to get on with their lives.
Is your day-to-day predictable? Or, like, so in private practice, you know, you can get that call from a client and all of a sudden your day, the day you thought you'd have is not the day you're having.
Or just for example, they can cancel ETAs for every Mexican client.
Or just for example, as today, all ETAs are canceled.
Just for example, yeah.
In, as being a judge, do you kind of know, like, this is how my day will look? Or, like, is there a similar call that can throw off your day?
Oh, so I know a year in advance whether I have a sitting day, and I know whether or not it's a travel week. In other words, so I have a certain six to eight travel weeks a year.
That's not vacation. That's where you're working at remote in the
I'm
province.
I'm traveling outside of Vancouver and New Westminster. Mm-hmm. So Vancouver and New Westminster are not considered travel for me. they're going to send me anywhere else.
Just didn't want people to think you're like, I get 8 weeks to travel.
No. Oh, sorry. No, this is traveling. These are travel weeks in the sense that I'm sitting somewhere other than, or I could be sitting somewhere other than Vancouver in the U.S.
Yeah.
So during my travel weeks, I don't know where. Like it could, you know, if I looked at my calendar right now, it might say that I'm in Courtney in May for a week or 2 weeks. From my perspective, those are just travel weeks. In other words, I'm traveling those weeks. It may be that they don't need a judge in Courtney that week and that they need a judge in Rossland or in Cranbrook or in Prince George. And so I may be in Prince George that week, or I may even start the week in Courtney. The matter that's in Courtney settles and then I get sent to Prince George, right? So I know that they're travel weeks and I arrange my life accordingly. Or if I have sitting weeks, I know that I'm sitting. I don't know what I'm going to be sitting on. It may be that I'm assigned a case. And in fact, for this 3 week period, I was going to be sitting on a 3 week case that settled. I was assigned another 3 week case that also settled. And now I'm back to being on, this was supposed to be a reserve week anyway, so I'm on reserve this week. Mm. But I knew in advance that this was going to be a reserve week, and I could have, I don't need to sit this week. I could choose to sit through one of my reserve weeks, but I won't be expected there's not an expectation that I would do that, which is why I knew that I was able to set this with the two of you. So when I know that I'm not sitting this week, but next week I'm sitting. But I don't know what I'll be hearing. So I'm sitting this week and next week and the week after in Vancouver. I may be in New West. I may be hearing a 2 week matter. I may hear 10 1 day matters. I may hear, so there's it'll be whatever is needed. At first, that was a bit, is very different than my experience as a counsel.
Sure.
Because as counsel, I was, you know, I knew a year in advance a lot of, you know, or I was scheduling, you know, for some of my stuff, I was scheduling months, at least months in advance.
Yeah.
And then I was always thinking about, okay, well, what's going on after that? And then I've got this, and then this is my kids, how I'm going to, you know, it's like a constant organization of filling in the calendar, especially as a litigator. That was a big part of my work. And while here I just don't have any control over it at all. And I've actually found it quite liberating.
Yeah, I can imagine.
At first it was very, because I chose, when I was at counsel, I picked my cases.
Yeah.
I assigned cases in my, you know, I would be as involved or as not involved in cases in my firm as I wanted to be. For the most part, and it was a question of saying, you know, I'll do this part of the case, I'm not going to do that part. But you know, we turned away a lot of cases, and I would go out looking for cases that I wanted to be involved in, right? So it wasn't even like I would actively be seeking out case. It wasn't just a question of what came in the door. It was, I want to litigate this issue, I'm going to go find that case, right? And that's no longer the case that at all. But in a way, I've actually found it quite, it's been quite liberating in a way that, one, it's forced me to do a lot of things that I wouldn't have thought would be rewarding that have turned out to be very rewarding, and have pushed me outside of my comfort zones and have pushed me into areas that I wouldn't have explored otherwise. But also, it was during the first summer that I was on. So I had put all my holidays into the summer to be with the kids. And where I didn't have, I actually was off for the summer because I wasn't thinking about what I was going to be doing in September, because there's no point in thinking about what I'm going to be doing in September because I don't have a case in September. I have sitting days in September.
Would you say it's less stressful than private practice or a different kind of stress being a judge?
Well, the difference in the stress in being a judge is in the decision making. So like most of my work starts after the hearing.
Right.
Right. So like once I've heard the case, and it's a very different type of writing. right? So like I'm a professional writer. What I do is I write decisions, mm-hmm. right? And that's really where the work is for me. And I find that it's very different than advocacy, mm-hmm. because advocacy is actually very, I'm not going to say it's simple, but I remember having this experience when I was appearing before committees in Parliament. And for the first several times that I appeared before committees in Parliament, it was always on behalf of an organization, the CBA or whatever. Often it was the CBA, but I appeared for other organizations as well. And there, you go in with a position, you present the position, you get, it was the same thing with advocacy, right? I go in, I present my, for advocacy. But then from time to time, so the first time that I was invited to a committee where it was like as an individual, I actually found it very, I was on the plane going to Ottawa, and then I was like, oh my God, I don't have a position. Like, I don't have a position. Like, nobody's given me a position. Like, what am I going to say if they ask me questions? Like, I actually have to come up with the answer. Like, as in, would they want to know what, and I was asked, well, Mr. Edelman, do you or do you not believe in deportation, right? And it was like, if I had been there for the CBA, mm-hmm. the CBA has a position on deportation, right. Which is da-da-da-da-da, right? That's the, and then, well, when you're there as an individual, you actually are, you have to make, which I had views on those things, and I expressed them at the time, but as to what those views were. But in terms of my position now, in terms of the writing, it's very different to write as a judge than it is to write as an advocate. Because as an advocate, it's very straightforward. Like, I don't have to worry about do I think my client should go to jail or not? That's not my job. Do I think my client should be deported or not? That's kind of irrelevant. I'm here to advocate for my client. My client's position is that he doesn't want to be deported. He doesn't want to go to jail, right? And my instructions from my client are that he doesn't want to go to jail, right? And here's the reasons why my client shouldn't go to jail, right? And then the Crown will come in and say, well, here's the reasons your client should go to jail or, should be deported or whatever it is. But as a judge, it's the writing is a very different exercise because ultimately, even when there's a joint submission, I'm the person who's sending this person to jail, right? And which to a certain extent was, that's something that even when Crown and Defense agree, that's still a significant decision for me to make.
Yeah.
And those are relatively easy. Like when you talk about easy decisions, you would think, because I had done so many joint submissions as counsel, where you come to an agreement with Crown, you say, okay, yes, this guy, we agree that he should go in for 6 months less a day, and here's the reasons, because the immigration consequences, and he's going to have an appeal, right, and all of these things. This makes a whole lot of sense, and then the judge will say, yeah, we'll impose that sentence, and they almost invariably will, given the law in the area. The threshold for not going along with a joint submission is quite high, but it's still.
It's the gravitas of the decision that is where the source of stress comes from, as opposed to the process. Yeah.
And it's not an easy decision to make.
Yeah.
Right? It's like sending somebody to the penitentiary.
Yeah.
Is not an easy decision to make.
For sure.
So taking a child, cutting a child off from his or her father or mother, or sending the kids, like those are not easy decisions to make, even if I have no doubt that it's the right decision.
Yeah.
Right? In the sense of, and sometimes...
Based on how the law is that you need to, but nobody's ever going to ask you, do you think that the system of imprisoning criminals like this is beyond the scope of what you're being asked to decide? It's strictly about, based on the application of the law and the circumstances of this case, what's the verdict?
But so speaking of having a position... I'm just thinking of some of the other, when people talk about becoming a judge, does it limit what you are? Do you feel like you're forced to self-censor what your positions are in public because mm-hmm. of the need to just be professional or avoid having a perception of bias? Like, do you find that it is limiting being a judge. The other one you hear is that it's lonely, which judging from the two judges who walked in earlier, it seems pretty collegial and a fun crowd. But those are the things you hear. Is that always it lonely? You're not allowed to have an opinion about things. Mm-hmm. Like what? I remember when we went for lunch a couple of years ago, you'd mentioned that you were seeing people less, but it was also a pandemic. So it wasn't clear if it's you becoming a judge or if it's a global pandemic. Where have you fallen on that since?
So, I mean, I find, so in terms of it being limiting, I mean, there are some things that I can't do that I used to do. In fact, part of the, my practice did involve a lot of media work, just as the nature of my, of the practice that I had. That's not work that I miss. It's not something, you know, like I did, you know, like I'd be on the CBC or the, you know, and I knew all of the journalists in different areas and whatnot. There was an aspect of that that I enjoyed, but it's not something that I miss. Mm-hmm. Obviously, it's not something that I'm going to be, you know, not doing interviews on CBC of, you know, whether they were my personal views or the views on behalf of my clients. But often it was, you know, to educate people about different areas of the law, but also to advocate on certain issues or areas. That was work that I did. In terms of engagement with certain communities, obviously it's not something that that's something that I do miss more, right? And so, I have been thinking about, I'm at the stage, my last few years have been a steep learning curve. Aside from the pandemic, there's also been a very steep learning curve for me in terms of all the areas of the law that I'm at a stage now where I'm sort of coming out of that. And I feel that I'm less, you know, I'm more familiar with the basics of the job. And so I have been thinking more about how I can engage with communities. So but there are opportunities to do that kind of stuff as a judge. So for example, I've been involved with the Justice and Education Society doing training for judges and prosecutors on human trafficking and human smuggling in Panama. And so there are other projects like that, whether they're local or engaging in different ways. It's just that given the office that I hold, there are certain things that I'm not going to be, in terms of the views that I express on certain issues, aren't going to be separated from the office.
Right. So like if you're at dinner with a group of friends and politics comes up, do you feel like, you know what, I don't need someone recording my thoughts on this possibly, or like...
It depends on how close the friends are, right? I mean, it depends... It's not that we don't have views, and it's not like the judges, you know, that we don't discuss things in the judges lounge or among friends that we still have views on the world and on things that go on in the world, and are still engaged in those things. But where it becomes an issue is the perception that my views ought to carry more weight, or that they would carry more weight because of the office that I hold, or that it's somehow linked to the office that I hold. And so that's where, you know, it would be a question of if I'm going to express those views, it would be in circumstances where I'm confident that people will make that dissociate those things. Or if they're not going to dissociate those things, you know, like when we're talking today, or when I'm talking on a panel at a conference as a judge, even though I'm not giving a judicial decision, I understand that the things that I'm going to say about the law are things that people are going to take in a certain way because it's being said by a judge.
Right? They'll hear it as Justice Adelman, not Peter, saying something.
Exactly. Yeah. And so those are circumstances where I would be less likely to be, or I would just be, you know, the role that I have is different, just like the views that you're going to express in court or in your professional capacity. Or, you know, do you express opinions about the law at a party?
Well, and we've got this issue even where on some podcast topics, like there's topics that maybe one of us has wanted to do. There's an active one that Deanna has wanted to do, and I've said, like, I think I'm conflicted out, mm-hmm. Which is, it is what it is. Mm-hmm. The last question, I'm just looking at in the, we're trying to keep these under an hour, and we have failed.
Oh, we failed. I haven't been watching the time
but
at
the,
all.
I just see it on our mic, is there's a shortage of judges. What are reasons someone should apply to be a judge, and what are not reasons someone should apply? By that, I don't mean like what are, if someone is considering to be a judge, what is a reason they may be considering to apply that actually isn't one? So like they think, you know, is, and as an example, like they think it will be good for their ego or something. Like what are some reasons to not apply to be a judge that you think people should know about?
Yeah, I mean, I think in terms of, I mean, ultimately,
or what's a bad reason to want to be a judge and a good reason?
If the reason that you're applying to be a, I mean, ultimately, the role of judges is one of public service. And that ought to be the main focus of the reasons that you're doing it, and that you think you can contribute to the role that is in whatever area, whether you're applying to the federal court or to the provincial court or to really in any decision-making capacity, that you're making decisions that have a significant impact in people's lives. And if you... if there's something else motivating you to do that that doesn't recognize the importance of the decisions in people's lives, then that's not a role you should be taking on. Mm. And that was true as counsel in terms of the cases that I was taking on, mm-hmm. as much as it is in terms of the reason that you become a judge, in the sense that if you don't recognize the importance of what the impact of what you're doing, then it's not something you ought to be doing.
Yeah. You've always been like a lawyer's lawyer. You really you were very interested in the law as a thing, as an instrument of change, and as a, you know, and I think, you know, when you were practicing law, we often talked about some of the limitations and constraints you felt in that respect. So to me, it was kind of it made a lot of sense as a transition for you trying to explore different ways of approaching the law, continuing to apply that sort of analytical skills, leaving behind the advocate component and... and so, I mean, that seems like a pretty obvious trajectory in those sorts of circumstances.
Yeah. No, and I think that to a certain extent, I think that for some people, in terms of the people who apply to become judges, I also don't think it should be something that is a role where people feel themselves restricted based on, in particular, on the history of who's been in the judiciary. Mm-hmm. Because it's something that the judiciary needs to evolve and needs to change.
Yeah.
And that it's not, it's about bringing good judgment as opposed to fitting a certain profile is, for me, is what's more important in terms of the people who take on the role and the impact that it's going to have in people's lives. And I think some of the best judges are people who have that type of insight and compassion and their ability to engage with the people who are before them versus having a particular pedigree, right? Which is, and I think that there in some circumstances, I know some of the people that I've encouraged to make applications perceive themselves as not having the pedigree.
Justice Shad Rashemi for Carl had Sadarashmi, had a video for Carl that she recorded that I think should be publicly available, where she talks about how in her own mind it was almost like she felt imposter syndrome that nobody else noticed, or nobody else would have thought, like, you don't belong here. Everybody else would have been wowed by skills, and how the whole process along, having to overcome that and, like, you know, realizing that someone did belong and was very respected.
Yeah, she's a great example.
When it's very important for people like Justice Sandra Hashemi or any of to be on the courts. Because that's where in terms of the discussions that I've been having with people about who are making that decision is that it's not like you say, there are good reasons not to become a judge, but there are also good reasons for people who wouldn't necessarily perceive themselves or see themselves in the historical judiciary to be on the modern judiciary.
Yeah. Where judges come on podcasts.
Yeah.
Where judges come on podcasts. Exactly.
One final comment, if I may, which is one thing that you said earlier about the kind of siloed approach to law. I think that this is our 100th episode. One thing that I think Steve and I have really been trying to do is to kind of the podcast is called Borderlines, but I think that it's sort of become slightly less about like physical borders and more about these sort of borders that like this kind of siloed approach and trying to have a more sort of elevated perspective. And I think that what you said about different perspectives coming from different areas of law, like I bemoan the fact that some of those insights gained in the family law sector are not being applied in the federal court. And I would love to see, you know, how there would be a better sharing of that same types of insight and institutional knowledge and wisdom into other areas as well. And also what you were talking about in terms of how, getting to the principle behind what the law is. This is something that you described as being an important skill for advocates. But I think that some of the issues that we've been talking about lately are about, you know, taking things back to first principles and trying to figure out what the doctrinal origin of this principle is and how you are going to base it from there. So I just wanted to kind of like, as like a theme to conclude the podcast and like, I think that is sort of where we're going at this stage. So it was nice to be able to do it with the three of us where we started out 100 episodes ago on this path. And I think it has changed course a lot, but that's what I'm looking forward to in the episodes to come, that we'll keep trying to expand on this idea.
Oh, that's awesome. No, and that's definitely one of the reasons that we had started.
Yeah.
That we had, you know, but we, when you look back at some of the people that we had, to bring academics on and especially from other areas, everything from real estate. I remember we did real estate
with David Eby.
With David Eby.
Housing crisis.
I know. I would love to have David Eby again to talk about the housing crisis. Yeah.
But everything from real estate to national security. We had Kent Roach. And anyway, there were the range of people that have been on has been, I have been listening over the, over more recent episodes where it's been, they're great discussions. I mean, it's really good to see those discussions continuing as well. So
it's taken on a bit of a life of its own.
So thank you for joining us. It's really nice.
Oh, that's great. I'm glad I was able to do this.
Let's go get lunch.
Yeah, let's do it.